Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Ellen DeGeneres doesn't know her own ATM pin. Oprah hasn't been inside a bank in nearly 30 years. Celebrities aren't just like us when it comes to their money in ways you might never have thought about. Whether it's because they're too busy or too rich, many celebrities have their own money handlers to manage their personal finances. We'll talk to Patricia Terrence, chartered accountant and business manager to the stars. Then, if you spend a little bit of time scrolling through Instagram, you might think that you're supposed to have it all. The dream job, the fancy house, the luxury car, the perfect meals, the gorgeous, well-behaved children. But all that, we know, it's an illusion, and it can be deeply demotivating. So what are we supposed to pay attention to? We'll talk to author Neen James about her new book, Attention Pays. It's about how to learn to unplug from constant disruptions and instead plug in to tools that harness our attention to reach our financial goals. Keeping up with the Joneses is a thing, of course. We're constantly comparing ourselves, but there might be some ways your financial advisor could help reduce those financial anxieties that come with those comparisons. We'll learn more about that with Morningstar's senior behavioral economist, Sarah Newcomb. Plus, breaking gender molds. When people think finance, female leaders aren't normally the first that come to mind. We're going to talk to a real estate investor, Tahini Abdurana, about how women can succeed in what is, for a lot of cases, a male-dominated industry. And Accenture's Jody Wallace gives us the latest on artificial intelligence in financial services. All that's ahead. Let's get started. How do celebrities manage their money? I mean, we do sort of think as celebrities of being a different species in so many different areas of their life. But as it relates to banking and shopping and getting a mortgage and all that kind of stuff, is their life more similar than different? I don't know. We're going to talk about celebrity money handlers. Patricia Terrence is our guest. She's a chartered accountant and business manager for a number of prominent Canadian entertainers. Hello there.
Hi there.
I'm not going to ask you to mention names, though, of course, I would love you to mention all names and tell me dishy stories about how you were handing wads of cash to clients to fulfill their cocaine habits during TIFF. But you probably wouldn't be allowed to tell me any of those things.
I would not be allowed to say any of those
How
things.
Did you get into a world in which you worked on the money of the rich and famous? How does that happen?
It starts by the accounting world. Entering the accounting world, I was just a regular accountant and met my business partner who was in the celebrity world, and that happened by happenstance. It was a friend who was in the industry, and then you get into it by one referral after the next and you build a practice.
Now, the accounting stuff, you know, you could compare those tasks like filing taxes to any other high net worth person. A celebrity is someone who might have a hard time going into a bank because of, you know, the attention that that would draw. Can you give us some examples of very practical things that you or your firm might do for someone of note that might be surprising? When we talk about Ellen doesn't know her ATM pin because someone would just hand her cash if she ever needs cash, because maybe she doesn't ever need it. But what things might a celebrity have taken care of that the rest of us have to do on our own?
Pretty much everything that has to do with money.
Really?
It really does.
The hydro bill. So really, they don't pay their own hydro.
They don't pay their own hydro. We pay their hydro. We pay everything from utilities to credit cards, buying vehicles, buying aircrafts, buying wedding rings. Everything you can think of, we take care of.
Now, your focus, you have a bit of a niche in music, as I understand it.
We do.
What's different about, you also have just generic high net worth people, just wealthy people.
We do.
What's different between someone whose wealth comes from a very public world and one who is quietly rich?
I would say the difference between the two are really about what sides of their brain they use. Because in the public entertainment world, they're far more creative and this is a little more foreign to them. So they really rely on the business managers to handle everything and make decisions along the way for them. As opposed to a high net worth individual, you're working constantly with them in making those decisions, as opposed to just giving the advice and directing it yourself. And I feel like in the entertainment industry, they have higher risk tolerance than the high net worth individuals. because of how they get there in their own careers.
How does your accounting brain say no to a celebrity who is used to a world in which everyone says yes?
Well, that's exactly why we are there.
Right.
It's easy for us to say no. The harder thing is for them to accept it. So for us, that's the easy part. It's how do we convince them not to move forward with certain decisions.
And what are some things that you, aside from imprisoning them in their own home without technology, how do you make that no stick?
You have to carry it out more than just the transaction. You have to show them the future of, you know, the, I would say more of the lifespan of that dollar and their career. You have to always put it in context of what's coming next. And I think that's how you can convince them. In some instances, you just simply can't. Mm. That's the reality of the industry. Sometimes you're reacting more than, you know, they're at the store, they're at the location, or they've made that decision, you're just transacting it.
Right.
So there's both sides.
How do you help them think long term in a period of hot fame? So if you think about any celebrity over time, they have periods when they are white hot, and no matter how famous you are, that isn't a forever state. How do you help them think about, listen, your monthly carry when you're making $10 million a year is sustainable. It's not when you're just living off the nest egg.
It's a little difficult because we have to squirrel away the money for them.
Yeah, and you can't use the phrase when you're no longer famous and working.
It's, you always have to manage your words when you're talking to them about their profession, because it's, you have to be their biggest supporter. But you also have to be realistic, and sometimes just like a conversation of death is a hard conversation to have, you have to have those conversations with them. And, that's why we're not alone in this. We bring in other help. We bring in brokers, we bring in investment advisors, and as a team, collectively, we help them see that future and.
How do you minimize the risk that you will enable bad behavior? So let's say, and it's a theoretical case, but we see it in the tabloids all the time. You're smiling. Listeners, she's smiling at me. Is we see these stories of bad behavior, and you, as the reader, you think someone is handing them the cash to, you know, pay for whatever, choose your vice. How do you find your own integrity in that, given that you do hold the purse strings to some extent?
We don't hold cash. So them accessing cash is really about who's around them in their circle on a day-to-day basis, in the sense of on the road, on the pavement. You can't control that. That's the reality of it.
Would you, at the risk of losing the client relationship, would you pull them aside and say, listen, the drugs are bad for your health. I don't manage your health, but I do manage your money. You got to stop the drugs.
We really don't get involved in that. We don't cross that line where we are wearing that hat. We really don't. We try to manage that because at the end of the day, you don't want them to see you as someone that's controlling them as opposed to controlling their money, managing the money. It's not controlling the money, it's managing the money. So we really walk that fine line.
How do you charge for your services? A traditional financial advisor who really just does investing, it's asset center management.
In the entertainment industry, there's industry standards of 5% of gross revenues.
5% of gross revenues, and that's for a business manager?
That's for a business manager in the entertainment industry. It can vary in various industries. It can go from percentage of revenues to retainers, monthly retainers, or just hourly.
So it's really good when one of your clients, you know, wins a Grammy, a Juno, or an Academy Award.
Of course. I mean, but with that comes time and increased time. So it's all relative in that sense.
I will never be a client of yours, but I'm so glad to learn how you work.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Patricia. Patricia Terrence, chartered accountant and business manager for a number of prominent entertainers, but we won't name names.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The world demands a lot from us these days. It seems like we're supposed to want everything, the job, the car, the paycheck, and we're supposed to pay attention to all of it too. We're supposed to scroll the feeds, respond to the texts, binge watch the shows. Our next guest argues that in order to create extraordinary lives, we have to learn to unplug from disruptions and plug into the tools that harness our attention to reach our highest potential. She is Neen James, author of Attention Pays, a book that focuses on how to drive profitability, productivity, and accountability. She joins us now from Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Hello there.
G'day, gorgeous. What a treat to be on the show.
Good day, because she's an Aussie, of course. You say when you pay attention, attention pays. What does that mean?
Think about it, Bruce. We've been told to pay attention since we were kids. Our parents told us to pay attention. Our teachers told us to pay attention. We think we're paying attention, but we're not. Paying attention is when we are truly thinking about, from a financial point of view, how do we pay better attention to our clients so they come back? From a team point of view, how do we pay attention to our team so we can attract and retain the top talent? And then personally, how do we pay attention to the people in our lives who we love and adore so that we can have deeper relationship? It pays on so many levels, financially, relationally, so many different ways.
This book comes at a time in which the demands on our attention have never been greater. I was driving my car yesterday and this woman was crossing a busy road while she was on her phone. She paid no attention to the fact that I was barreling towards her. And that's just one of any of a thousand examples we could each cite, both as observers and as individuals on this planet. How would you characterize the challenge that the average human being has these days paying attention?
You know, it's interesting you say that because 9 people die every day because of distracted driving, Bruce. I mean, that's insanity. And the reason I think this happens is what we call in the book, we have a book called Attention Pays. And in the book, we call this the over trilogy. People are overwhelmed, they're overstressed, and they're overtired. This crazy combination in an environment where the expectations of us from our boss, from our team, from our partners, from all of the people that are important to us becomes way too much for us. And I think what happens is we split our attention in so many ways and yet get no traction. And so we have to think about how do we overcome this over trilogy?
As with everything on this show, we look at all of it through the lens of personal finance. When you think about people and their money, what is immediately relevant when it comes to attention, do you think?
Classic example yesterday and a tiny example. I wasn't paying attention when I bought a ticket to catch a train. And interestingly, I was rushing to the station. I paid no attention, even though I am supposedly an attention expert. I bought the wrong ticket, therefore I had to get a refund and reissue another one. This tiny example happens over and over in our lives. When we don't pay attention to our retirement and our savings, fast forward a few years, we don't have what it is we need to take care of the family we have. When we don't pay attention to putting money away for the people we care about for their education, we find it challenging to pay for their education and their students, and maybe they have bigger student loans. Think about things like even our mortgages. Imagine if we paid more attention to being deliberate about those payments and paying sometimes that little bit extra if we could. Imagine how much interest we would save. When it comes to paying attention, it's also the fundamentals of understanding where is our money going. Imagine if we just tracked, whether we wrote it down or used a spreadsheet or an app, just what our spending was for 30 days. Paying attention at the end of that 30 days to say, where do all those little bits of money go? I know for myself, if a $20 bill gets broken, it just vanishes, right? And so where is that money going? And so when it comes to paying attention to our finances, I think we have to be incredibly diligent and just monitor and focus, even if it's just for 30 days. That would be my challenge to the listeners. And then at the end of that 30 days, summarize what are the major categories? Are there places you can save? Are there places you need to invest more? But we need to start paying attention, not just on this in the 30 days, but sometimes each day. I did an experiment last year where I spent the whole entire month of January trying not to spend any money. It's harder than we actually think. Do you know what it did for me, Bruce? It made me pay attention to every time I'd open my wallet at a Starbucks, when I'd get a snack at the airport, all those little tiny bits of money that we give away. And it's almost thoughtless when we do it. It's these habits we got into. And it really raised my awareness of what I was spending online. Those stupid things like Amazon One Click, which makes life too easy for us to buy on an impulse. These are things I started to pay more attention to.
A lot of your work in the corporate world is in for people who have an accountability to sell. So they sell stuff. As you think about the relationship dynamic in sales, what is it that you would have people focus on? Because even if you aren't in sales, most people work in jobs in which relationships really matter. In today's day and age, people text the person sitting next to them, or they're having a Slack conversation with someone who's two cubicles over instead of having the conversation. What are the values, or what are the tactics? What are the things that we should do to stem the tide of the technology taking over everything?
You know, the best lesson I ever got, Bruce, was from a five-year-old. And you know the wisdom of your seven-year-old, right? So the wisdom of my five-year-old friend, he and I were in a little bit of a debate, as you do with small children. And he said to me, he grabbed my face in his tiny little hands. He turned it towards him and he said, "Mean, listen with your eyes." I mean, Bruce.
I just got goosebumps.
Right? And this is what we need to do. We really need to listen with our eyes, whether we are in sales listening to the potential client we want to serve, whether we are a leader listening in our team meeting to the concerns of our team, whether we are an entrepreneur listening to what's going on in the marketplace and how we can better grow our business, whether we are a partner and we are trying to care more deeply for our spouse, for our little people, for our furry babies we share in our home. We need to listen with our eyes. It changes everything.
Wow. You have a phrase called the attention revolution, which I hope has a dance song. I hope this has a dance song, like a Pink or, I don't know, Britney Spears retro remix. What's an attention revolution, and why did you start that?
I am obsessed with getting the world to pay attention, and I believe we pay attention in three ways. Personally, it's about who deserves your attention and how you can be more thoughtful. Professionally, it's about what you pay attention to and being more productive. And thirdly, it's about globally paying attention, which means being responsible on how we pay attention in the world. Who, what, and how we pay attention. This attention revolution is going to change the way that people show up as leaders, as partners, as workers. We need to start really thinking about where we can manage our attention. See, we don't have a time management crisis. We have an attention crisis. And I want to fix that with the attention revolution.
I was so focused on our conversation. I hope you felt it. I was listening with my eyes through the microphone. Did you feel it?
I did.
I'm
so good at this.
Relieved.
You are awesome in the way you interview people. I've seen you MC and rock hundreds of people because you do listen with your eyes, and then you can repeat back to your guests what they say. It's amazing.
Neen James, thank you. Thank you very much. Neen James, author of Attention Pays. Coming up on the program, personal finance and artificial intelligence. What AI can do to help you get a better handle on your money. And later, keeping up with the Joneses, how social comparisons can impact your financial well-being. You can find me on Twitter at Bruce Selry, Facebook, Bruce Selry, Moolala. I am not on Instagram. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Selry on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Artificial intelligence is pretty common today, even if you can't see it. You might have an AI personal assistant in your home. Cars are driving themselves some places. You can even get a medical diagnosis from a robot for some stuff. But AI is also being used as a way to help you manage your money. Here to tell us more is Accenture's Managing Director of Artificial Intelligence in Canada, Jody Wallace. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
We hear a lot about AI. A lot. How would you define the term for those who don't know what it actually means?
Yeah, and I'll give you my practical definition.
Oh, because, good. I like it.
Yes, because first of all, I'm not sure I could come up with a very scientific definition. And second of all, it's not that helpful in the context of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So practically, I think of AI this way. I think about it as a collection of technologies that work together. And what they do is they sense the world around them. They make sense of the data that they collect, and then they act on that data in a way that is meaningful or helpful. And what underlies these technologies, what makes them, in my opinion, qualified as artificial intelligence technologies, is their ability to learn. Mm. That's not always an ability to learn completely on their own, like in a movie context.
Yep.
It could be they can learn by being trained by humans, learn by being trained by images, learn by being trained by other types of data, learn through trial and error. But what is common to them is an ability to learn, adapt, and get smarter over time.
What are some of the potential applications in market or otherwise as it relates to how people manage their money? Some consumers might see, some might they might never see, but what are some of the big themes that people are talking about or even doing?
So I think the biggest theme is the evolution of what we've called personal financial management software. So personal financial management software, which has been around for a long time, started out as you make a budget. And then the personal financial management software will help you by telling you if you're tracking to that budget. And usually it's a spending budget or a saving budget. With AI, we move to a personal financial management capability that learns about you, learns about others like you, and then generates some insights for you without having you to basically tell it all of the rules, generates insights about what you can do to save more or perhaps to spend more wisely or perhaps to invest in different ways. Mm. So it's really the insight generation associated with PFM, but not insights based on what you tell it, insights based on what it learns.
And clearly we are not there. We are not there. And here's my example of how not there we are. My 8-year-old has a bank account. It's a kid's bank. She was there when we set it up. They send a letter. It's addressed to her. She's so excited. She opens it up. It does nothing to acknowledge the fact that she's 8. And instead, it outlines the fee changes on her account that she now can have, like, her checking is $20 instead of whatever it is. And she was so disappointed. What are the hurdles to AI being rolled out in a meaningful way so that instead of that, Abby got like a picture of a hamster? She loves hamsters.
So I'm going to guess that this was probably a traditional institution where
yes.
Abby opened her account.
Yes.
Right. I mean, I think the biggest hurdle for our traditional institutions is really navigating what I would call their legacy environment. So their legacy environment is the way they've always been structured organizationally, the systems that have been in place for the last 30 or 40 years, and the ability of those organizational structures and systems to adapt to allow for the introduction and the embedding, really, of this type of artificial intelligence capability we're talking about.
How do traditional institutions navigate the potential conflicts of interest that they face? I was at a session yesterday where someone talked about the evil of the banks. I don't happen to share that view, but they do have a tough, if not ethical, then business question, because we think about the self-driving cars. So that self-driving car needs to learn, do I kill the 8-year-old or do I kill the senior? Someone's going to die in that scenario. Who do I kill? And in a financial context, do I want the profit to my credit card business or do I want it to insert other line of business there? How do you navigate that?
Right. And I think it, I don't think they're evil either, by the way. So I share that.
Well,
you
would be out of a job if you thought they were evil.
But I think there's even another conflict of interest to navigate. What if the best insight I can deliver you is going to cause you to spend less with the bank?
Yeah.
Or to use your credit card less, or to take less credit in general,
yeah,
or to save more at a higher interest rate? What if the insights that I can deliver to you actually do better for you, but worse for me as
an
organization?
It's not even a what if question. It's practical because
absolutely,
we know, and I don't know what the data point is, but we know that Canadians have, say they've got $1,000, say they've got $3,000 in a savings account and $1,000 outstanding on a credit card. The no brainer, it's not even AI, it's someone who pulls up their portfolio and says, you know, you should just pay off your credit card, right? the banks currently don't prompt you to do that.
And there's a number of reasons for that. One is I think that they don't necessarily know enough about you and your intentions for that money to give you good advice, right? Perhaps you have $3,000 sitting there because you're about to make a large purchase,
yep,
or it's going towards a down payment of a house. They don't know enough about you. With artificial intelligence, we actually have the ability to learn about you. Now, it's got to be done in a context that you agree to. In other words, the data that you share, you have to agree, can be shared and used to provide you with better products and services.
Yeah, I think that whole thing is a red herring. And I'll tell you why I think it's a red herring. I get asked about that all the time. And you know how many times I don't accept the terms and conditions?
Never.
Never. Right. I always accept them. And the reason is I don't know. I don't have any choice. So to pretend that a consumer has agency over that, it's just...
Well, you don't have agency. Right. You don't have agency over the terms of condition, but you certainly have agency over whether you have a Facebook account, whether you engage on Instagram. I mean, I think you have a little bit
of
control.
You do at the margins.
Right.
But you also realize you live in Canada in 2018.
Right. And you may walk down a street with some sensors.
Yeah, and they take a video of you or whatever. So it's not that that's not a part of the mosaic. It's just not realistic. Like, I'm not going to not get the whatever. But I'm not going to prevent the bank from looking at my credit card data or whatever. They've got it. They've got all that stuff inside. So let's come back to the conflicts. Okay. How do they navigate it?
I think it's a series of discussions and constant evolution. So some of the ways in which they navigate it is, you know, they'll set up a task force to look at some of these issues and come up with the pros and cons and model it financially. And at the end of the day, what they're doing is they're saying, how can I improve my relationship with my customers to the point where they're going to stay with me if they're already customers and they're going to want to come to me if they're not already customers, right? That ultimately is what's going to drive them at the end of the day. You can call it customer experience, you can call it customer relationships, you can call it whatever you want. But at the end of the day, they are in business because they are making a certain segment of the population very happy or at least very satisfied. And they need to continue to satisfy their customers' needs in order to continue to be a viable organization.
Certainly financial services is not a leader in AI compared to other sectors who've been at it longer and who are predisposed to tech, who are built. And let's use Amazon as an example. So Alexa is a whole different thing. How do the incumbents perceive the threat of non-banks doing banking type things?
So that's been an evolution as far as I have observed, right? The first was there was a lot of talk several years ago about the disruptors are coming, they're going to change our entire landscape, you know, our business is not going to be the same. The reality is we look, you know, from 5 years ago to today, the organizations pretty much look the same way that they did. Yes, they offer more and better digital products and services, but they look largely the same organizationally as they did. I think a couple of things have happened. One is disruptors have really operated at the margins, right? So there's no disruptor that's come in and say, I'm going to completely take over an entire portfolio of a customer or the entire financial life of a customer. Some have come in and really done a great job in a very, very specific area.
In wealth, in investing.
Wealthsimple,
like the
robos, is a perfect example. Yeah. Right. So the first thing is that is we realize, and those that have started in one area and tried to scale to other areas have not had a ton of success. So SoFi, for example, in the U.S., which very successfully came out and took a big part of the student loan refinance business, they then tried to scale to other products and services and ultimately sold. Mm. And that's kind of been the same story. So the new entrants or the disruptive entrants seem to do a really good job in a niche area, but haven't really figured out how to scale. Yeah. So that's one thing that's happened. And the second thing is I think that the banks have just gone out and started buying them.
Right.
Right. And so
they become enablers versus challengers.
Right. And in some cases, they've tucked them into their, embedded them into their operations. In some cases, they've let them retain their sense of smallness and nimbleness and you know, in the case of Wealthsimple and Power Corp, right? They've let them stay on their own and operate on their own as a challenger, as you say.
You have a new podcast out with Amanda Lang. What is one of the most interesting topics you covered in that? I wish I had longer to answer that question. You've got 30 seconds, but I want to hear about your podcast.
So, I mean, first of all, the podcast was a really interesting way of saying, let's talk to all the stakeholders in the ecosystem. Let's look at government, policymakers, industry, venture capitalists, small business, academic researchers, and talk to them all about the same topic and see what we can try. And what do we agree on? What do we disagree on? I think one of my favorite quotes in the whole series was from Dr. Rich Zemmel, who's the research director at the Vector Institute. And he said, you know, on the topic of privacy, what we are really focused on is what Facebook is doing and what Google is doing. He said, but they're a handful of large organizations with huge scrutiny on them. There are millions of startups, millions of small companies that we are engaging with, whether we know it or not. Who's watching them? Where is the scrutiny over them? And do we have the right mindset of only watching a few? Or do we need to really think differently about where some of our risks are?
Wow. Jody, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Jody Wallace is with Accenture. She's the Managing Director of Artificial Intelligence in Canada. Stay with us. Coming up later, the Moolala Questionnaire. But next, social comparisons. We're going to talk to behavioral economist Sarah Newcomb about how financial advisors can help reduce their clients' financial anxiety. I'm also the money columnist for Money Sense. It's an online personal finance and lifestyle magazine. You can check out some of the segments that I have written at moneysense.ca and search for me. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after this break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Remember when you just took a vacation? You just took a vacation and you got home and it was great. Maybe you told your colleagues about it. Now, when you're on your vacation, you have to think, which photo am I going to put up on Facebook that tells the world how amazing my vacation was? And, you know, maybe even how much better my vacation was than your vacation. We compare ourselves more so to other people perhaps than any other time in history. And financially, that can have pros and cons. There's some interesting new insight on this topic, in particular as it relates to financial advisors and how advisors might be able to reduce financial anxieties on the part of their clients and improve a client's financial well-being by looking more closely at social comparisons, is what they're called. Sarah Newcomb is our guest. She joins us from Washington, D.C., where she is the senior behavioral scientist at Morningstar. Hello there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So, you've done a lot of work on social comparisons. This is a FOMO, fear of missing out world. Social media has been a catalyst for that. I want to ask you first off, what are some of the most important findings from the report you just published?
Well, what will probably come as no surprise is that everyone in every income group tended to compare themselves to people they thought were doing better. So we're all comparing upward. And comparing upward was related, strongly related, with feeling down. So we're making upward comparisons, and it's making us feel bad. This is probably won't be a surprise to anyone who has ever looked at their neighbor's Mercedes and felt a little pit in their stomach. But it's good to start to see the trends in the numbers and what this can tell us about our financial health.
What are the pros of social comparisons, or are there any?
There can be some. And I think that sometimes we think of this as like, oh, it's a motivator. I'm looking at what others have to keep me motivated. What my work would say is that it's not working as a motivator. Hmm. Although I will tell you, there is one thing you can do that I'll in a moment that can really help. But I want to say this. A lot of people will tell you, oh, stop comparing yourself to other people. Just don't do it. It's a waste of time. Now, it might be a waste of time, and it might be something that has a negative impact, but it's not something that humans can stop doing. Social comparison theory has been around since the 1950s. It's a very well-established theory in psychology of how humans establish ourselves in our pecking order, so to speak. It's an innate need to know where we stand in the social hierarchy and how valuable we are. We can't stop ourselves from comparing ourselves to others. So it's really unrealistic to just say, well, I'm going to stop comparing myself. So the challenge has got to be, how can we do it in a way that doesn't hurt us?
And how do we do it in a way that doesn't hurt us? I mean, I've seen examples in the marketplace of leaderboards for a, you know, an online investment club. I've seen people like me examples where you're, you know, the example would be someone who earns your salary puts 5% away for retirement savings. So those kinds of examples. What would be guiding principles that you might apply to have institutions do it right?
Well, I asked people who they tended to compare themselves to, and most people compare themselves to colleagues and friends or a family member. Some people compare themselves to their neighbors, some to celebrities and business people, but a very small group of people compare themselves to a mentor or a role model, and those people felt great about their money, regardless of whether or not the mentor or role model was financially better off or worse off than they were. And that led me to a follow-up study where I put some people through a very short and simple role model exercise, and I had them choose a financial role model and answer a couple specific questions about that person, like what are the qualities of that person that allow them to exhibit the behaviors that you think are leading them to their good financial situation? And do you share any of those qualities? And what can you do to be a little bit more like that person today? The other group I had compare themselves to whoever they normally do and ask them a few questions about how they feel about that and so on. The people who went through this 2-minute role model exercise showed much higher confidence that they could reach their goals, much stronger determination to reach their goals, and they had a stronger feeling of control over their financial future than the people who compared themselves to anyone other than a role model. So it's really very simple. By choosing a financial role model, somebody whose quality of financial decisions, not the amount of stuff, but the quality of their financial decisions that you admire, but you feel like you really can walk in their shoes, that's a way to direct your need to compare yourself to something that's aspirational rather than something that's evaluative. You're not asking yourself, how do I measure up right now? And am I as good as my neighbor? You're asking yourself, what do I admire about this person and how can I emulate that to be even better in the future? And that changes everything when it comes to your own financial priorities, whether you're going to be trying to keep up with the Joneses, which generally, I don't know if you know, but the Joneses went broke. And or really deciding what is it that you want to be and have that it also includes peace of mind. And that's where the role model can come in.
Can you do this at scale? Because it sounds like you're talking about a very customized thing where your test group identified someone that they know. Is there a way to do that at scale?
Well, I'm not sure that it even has to be someone you know, as long as it's someone that you believe you have some insight into their behavior. I mean, when I did this, the trends that I saw in what people admired, it was interesting. Very few of them said, oh, they have all the money they could want. Most people named things like they're really disciplined and they plan well, or they think very clearly. I want to be more like that. They're not as impulsive as I am. And it was interesting to see that what we admire about other people is really the opposite of spending a lot of money and having a lot of stuff. But it's, I think socially what happens is that we see people's stuff. We don't see their savings. Mm. And so reminding yourself that there are actions and there are qualities that lead to good financial behavior. Yes, I think it can scale because it's so simple. Anybody can do it in 2 minutes.
Briefly, before we go here, there's a lot of talk about behavioral economics in the context of potential conflicts of interest that exist on having consumers do the best thing for them and having them do the things that are going to reward the publicly traded companies where their accounts are held. As it relates to social comparisons, how do you think through those conflicts or flag those conflicts, or how do you think about that question?
I think that's a really interesting angle. I think whenever it comes to financial decisions, everyone needs to know the difference between a financial product and a financial service and shop for financial products like you shop for other products. You look at the attributes. You don't trust the salesperson to tell you you look great in the dress because you know they're getting a commission. when it comes to the social and the financial incentives of financial salespeople, you know, they're looking up too. They're comparing themselves with people who are making more than them. Their incentive is going to be to have more. And that might be by getting people to buy products that aren't good for them. I think, you know, when it comes to the buyer of the product, so many mistakes have been made, starting with the sentence, "I've got a guy." And I think, you know, don't get pulled into the social pull of wanting to be impressive because of your investments.
Right.
What's impressive is being able to sleep at night.
Sarah, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Newcomb, Senior Behavioral Scientist at Morningstar on social comparisons. Stay with us. Coming up next, sorry about your glass ceiling. Did I break that? Sorry, not sorry. We'll talk to real estate investor Tahani Aburea for tips on how women can succeed in a male-dominated industry. We'll also take you through the new Moolala questionnaire with Neen James. And if that isn't enough Moolala for you, you can pick up one of my books. Order them online. The first is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Picture the following person in your mind: real estate investor, land developer, founder of five companies, self-made millionaire. Did you imagine this person to be a man or a woman? Well, the data would say you probably pictured a dude because that's what most brains do. So it is my great pleasure to introduce a female breaking the mold in real estate, a pretty male-dominated industry. Her name is Tahani Aburea, and she joins us now. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
You have broken the proverbial glass ceiling in many parts of your industry, and you've done it with a backstory that would be a great Hollywood movie, if it wasn't the life you have lived. Give us a bit of a sense for how you arrived at the point that you are, given the extra hurdles that you had to overcome, including a marriage very young, yes, life in a refugee camp. Like, what's the flavor of that, yes, that the backstory?
How many hours do we have here?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Exactly. So first of all, thank you for having me here. And I'm going to start by saying I was born in a refugee camp in Jordan, Amman. And at age 15, I was coming home from a normal school day, beautiful winter day, and to find out that there is a party in my house. And as I walked in, I'm like, what is this commotion about? And then all of a sudden, all I hear is like, Tahani, congratulations. And I'm like, what's just happened?
Did I just win the lottery?
That's what I was thinking. And then they said, you just got married. And in my mind was like, who? So that was, this is how it all started.
In the culture at the time, was an arranged marriage to such a young person uncommon, or was that
very common? Culturally is very common, but I did not expect it at all. Like, I just did not expect it. I was just in grade 9 and I was just coming home and 15 years old. That's what it was. And but it was common. Yes.
I can't even imagine the number of chapters that went from that day to the day you landed in Canada. But how did you then arrive here in Canada those years later?
Like, in terms of...
You were married to this person?
Yes.
And then...
Yes. First of all, I found huge differences, right? For me, I found a lot of differences. I mean, there's, you know, girls wearing short skirts, you know, guys holding girls' hands, totally different. But what also is, it was the other way around. The kids in Canada also found huge differences. Like, how is a 15-year-old, you know, in grade 9, 10 at school being married? So where all the kids would go home and play with their friends and do their, games or soccer, whatever it is, I would go home and I would attend to my housewife duties. So it was...
So you were married... Was your husband Canadian?
He lived in Canada, yes.
So you were not only married, but you were ripped from your family.
It was, it was very hard, but I know my dad has the best intention because, you know, we were such a humble beginning. He didn't have money to send me to school, and he knew how much I loved education and what education meant to me. So it was for him, it's an opportunity for me to go and finish my education in Canada, but also hoping that I would help my family back home in the refugee camp once I make it here in Canada. So there was a lot of responsibility on a 15-year-old young girl.
That's an understatement. Maybe the understatement of the century. Yes. I want to talk a bit about the life you have today, and then I'm going to, you know, rewind the clock to talk a bit about money growing up, because this is a personal finance show. What we talk about is how people can get a better handle on their money. Oh. But as context, you have the context of the past, and you also have the context of your present, which is successful in very traditional ways. So give us one or two highlights of the world you have created work-wise, and what you're proudest of.
I would have never, ever, ever, ever imagined to be where I'm at right now. And I'm very, very proud of many things. But the most I'm proud of is really my two kids. It's just that they're not really young kids anymore. They're older, they're adults. But I'm very, very proud of my kids, very much so. But having come from that, I would have never imagined to be a builder, developer, to be teaching thousands of real estate investing on how to make money through real estate, you know, to becoming a best-selling author with one of the largest, you know, North America publishers, Wiley and Sons, to, you know, to speaker to, it just, it was just almost like a dream come true.
How did the move to real estate happen?
So I actually wanted to help my brother, who asked me if I could help him maybe buy a few little toys and sell it in a flea market. And I'm like, why buy, you know, why sell it in a flea market? Why not open a real estate, open a store? And when we opened the store for him, I turned it into a dollar store. And that was just at the beginning of the craze of the dollar store in the early
90s. I spent
90s.
A lot of time in dollar stores with an 8-year-old daughter.
But across the road, there was a brokerage and a real estate manager broker that would come and buy gum or water, you know, little things. And then he would see me interact with people. And then he would say, you should get into real estate. You should get into real estate. You should. And then finally, I made the move and I got into real estate. But not until actually I went through a divorce that I found about real estate investing. Because I was just focused and I thought, I'm going to do whatever it takes to take care of my two kids and make it in this world. And I went on asking anybody that I know if they want to buy or sell real estate. Then I stumbled upon Ash, and Ash is a mechanic who wanted an investment property. And I said to Ash, I'll find you whatever you want. Just tell me what you want. I'll go find that property for you. I did. 3.5 months later, I sold that property for Ash, and I saw how he made $48,000.
And were hooked.
And I was like, oh my gosh. Yes, exactly.
What? How did you think, when you think back to your time growing up in a refugee camp and what would be by many standards humble beginnings, how did you think about money back then? Did you think we're poor, we can't afford things, or was it just the reality of your life at the time?
It was the reality of my life, but I've never, ever, ever felt poor. It's funny because even the days that we had nothing but bread to dip in tea to eat for dinner, I still never felt poor because there was always people that had less than us. And we had some, at least we had, you know, food to eat. There were people that did not have food to eat, you know. So I've always looked at myself over there and here and all the time of how grateful I am for what I've got, rather than always thinking, oh, you know, it's greener on the other side and I don't have this and I don't have that. And
you have a bunch of tips for helping women succeed. One of them is forget about fitting in. How did you come to this? And for some of our listeners, that would be contrarian advice. They would have the opposite advice.
Yes, because women always look at when they go into a male-dominated, you know, industry, like say it's a conference or a room full of men. They say to themselves, maybe, oh my goodness, I'm the only woman. I don't know, you know, how am I going to fit in? Rather than seeing the opposite, it's all about perspective. So seeing the other side and the perspective of like, wow, I'm the only woman here. This is awesome, you know, and think of all these men as brothers, family, and then it just becomes very natural, and then they can just, you know, fit in. Really, it's
what did you learn about building rapport? Or would you say this is your temperament? It's who you are.
It is of course, it is who I am. But for the ones that think of themselves as introverts, it's really just find something that is when I look at people, I always look at the child within that person, whether it's a guy or a girl. I always see the child within them. And then there is always something that they have that is interesting. Everybody has a story. And if you just kind of talk and ask about who they are, then all of a sudden it opens the door to, to having a report that is more authentic rather than here is my business card and, you know, tell me what you do and I want to know what you do, just which is totally unauthentic.
We are in a particular time in history, in the time of Me Too, in the time of Time's Up. What is your take on all that has been unfolding there and how it relates to your journey and your efforts to mentor and lead other female executives?
I am a total supporter of the whole movement thing, you know, because I believe these women are so courageous and they took such a huge a chance to come out and speak about what's been happening to them, which leads to the awareness, or it brings out the awareness of, you know, no woman should really be sitting on something like that, feeling whether it's ashamed or she can do something about it and just go out and really And just pave the way for other women, not to just only think about yourself. Think about, you know, if you come out and talk about, you know, what's been holding you back, that maybe some other woman can benefit from that.
We could talk all day. Tahini, thank you.
We can,
because
yes.
I have rapport too.
Yes.
You're just like me.
Thank you.
Thank you for making the time to come in and see us.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you.
Tahini Aburana is Tahani. Thank you for the correction. Oh my gosh. Tahani. How'd I do in the last name?
Aburani, yes. That's okay.
Okay, I will take it. Thank you for joining
us.
You're
welcome. Thank you so much.
Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. This is when we talk a little bit about money and money personalities. It is our spin on the Proust questionnaire from Vanity Fair. Our guest, Neen James, author of Attention Pays, a book that focuses on how to drive profitability, productivity, and accountability. Wow, that's a very serious, Neen, that is a very serious phrase that is almost seems like counter to the playful you that I have come to know and love.
I know, but imagine if the world paid attention. Imagine if we paid attention to our finances, to our people, to the results. Imagine how different our lives would be.
All right, question number one. How would you describe your money personality?
I'm very generous. I know how to spend money like nobody else.
Wow. Okay, and are you one of those over-tippers that makes me look bad?
I am, because here's my thing. I always believe there's a story behind every person. I always leave $20 in the hotel room for my people who take care of my room, because I always believe they are doing this because they are in service of others. And so I'm very generous when it comes to tipping. I'm privileged to do what I do, and I want to make sure people in service know how much I value them.
Who was your money mentor growing up?
I want to say I didn't always have strong role models growing up, but when I got married, my husband was so phenomenal at doing that. So I think I learned my best lessons once I got married. Now, I was married at 19, so that's kind of growing up, right? I was like a little person.
Yeah,
so
you're a little person.
I'm going to say, and I still am, 4'10 and a half, and at half, it obviously matters. I think my husband is probably one of the best at budgeting and also being able to balance the generosity.
What is one financial behavior for you that you'd say you're still a bit of a work in progress on?
For me, I think it's about long-term retirement planning. For me, I love being able to be right here, right now, and enjoying the experience of it. But as I get older, I know I sound like I'm five, but as I get older, I realize that that's something that I'm going to have to be super diligent about, especially in the next 10 years. So for me, I think the area of development and work in progress is definitely long-term retirement planning.
When do you think you will retire, and what will you do? Or are you part of this grand trend to people who say, I'm never going to retire? What are you, crazy? Or will you, you know, pack it in and move to your place and on Bondi Beach or in the Whitsundays?
You know, I don't think that speakers retire. I think if anything, you know, the older and wiser you are, sometimes in my profession, the more valuable you are. But in my belief, retirement looks like traveling more with my husband for pleasure. And so for me, I want to be able to create a lifestyle that allows me to have more vacation time than I do now, and to leverage the wonderful places I get to go on the globe, but to take him with me. So retirement for me looks like I'm still working and traveling, but not at the crazy pace I do now, and definitely more for pleasure.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Hands down, it would be my red-soled shoes. I love Louboutins, and so I love the feeling of my stilettos, so that is definitely a guilty pleasure for me.
How many pairs of shoes do you have?
You know, that is like asking a woman how old she is. Is it really?
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that was a thing I wasn't supposed to ask.
I cannot tell you in public, because if someone does the math, then that's not...
There's your retirement savings plan.
I know, that's exactly what I knew you would think. So yeah, I have quite a few pairs, and I love them all.
Wow. If you landed a huge financial windfall, I'm calling that $25 million, what would you do with it?
I'd set up a foundation. I would make sure that a huge amount of that was allocated to things that I really believed in, people that I really wanted to support. So that's probably where I'd start first. I'd look at some of the biggest challenges that people are facing, and I'd work out how I could solve those.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
I would get everyone to tithe 10% of everything they earn. Take 10% out and give it away automatically before they spend anything. That would be one behavior I would change.
I've never heard that one, and I love it. Neen, thank you for your wisdom, your wit, and your warmth. Ooh, alliteration. Wow. I don't know how I did that.
Ooh, look at you, fancy. It was my absolute privilege.
Neen James is the author of Attention Pays. She joined us from Pennsylvania. That's our program for today. You can tell us what you thought of it. I'd be interested in hearing. I kind of thought it was pretty good, especially Neen. She's great. Send us your thoughts and any questions you have to ask at moolala.ca. You can connect with me on Twitter at Bruce Selry or Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. If you want to listen to the program, you've got a bunch of options. You can go to iTunes. You can subscribe to the show. You can also go to moolala.ca and download the entire show or listen to specific segments if you'd like. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great day.